Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, back on the air again. This week's show is sponsored by Acme Smoked Fish, and I'll tell you something about Acme. Located in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, Acme has been a mainstay in New York culinary landscape for over 55 years. Using old world recipes, Acme produces the finest smoked salmon, whitefish, and sable that discriminating palates demand. For information on where to find Acme, Blue Hill Bay, or Ruby Bay products, visit www.acmesmokedfish.com. So today's show, I'm lucky I have my favorite co-host is back again, Carol Butler. And Carol's going to talk about a lot of strategies that we love to talk about for survival, mimicry, and all that stuff. And before we get started, Carol, do you like smoked fish and that
I
kind
do.
Of stuff?
I do.
Okay, how about sable?
It's okay.
Yeah? Okay.
Not my first choice.
Which is your first choice?
I like lox.
You like lox?
Yes.
Okay. But I like sable. And you know what sable is? Sable is black cod.
Mm-hmm.
It's another name for it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, everybody calls it sable because
right.
I think because it's so smooth and
right.
like that. But it's really a black cod.
All
and
right.
black cods are very expensive. You go to buy them fresh in the fish store, but the meat, the flesh of the black cod is delicious,
okay.
even just broiled.
Would it's be really nice if we had a little sample
yes,
here.
We don't have a sample, but we'll get along. Okay, so Carol, you want to start off today and talk about
the first topic? I'm going to start off talking about mimicry for a little. I have a little bits and pieces that I've collected for the show.
Sort of a magazine.
A magazine, exactly. I did a show several weeks ago about mimicry, which is archived on the website, so you can listen to it. And we posted quite a few illustrations of different mimicry in butterflies. So we showed the model and the mimic. Batesian mimicry, which was described, this is just another little addendum to the notion of mimicry. I talked about all sorts of variations. This is another variation that I left out. Batesian mimicry was described first by a British explorer whose name was Henry Walker Bates, and this was in the 1860s. And Batesian mimicry says that the edible species can gain protection from predators by resembling distasteful toxic species, right?
Mm-hmm.
So his assumption was that predators learned which prey in the range were to be avoided, because they got sick to the stomach if they ate a toxic butterfly. So they knew to avoid that butterfly. And then the mimic would develop to closely resemble the model, and then the predator, like the bird, would stay away from a butterfly that looked like the toxic species. That's Batesian mimicry. And the mimic would evolve over time to resemble the model.
Mm. Okay, yeah. Yes. Was he a colleague of Darwin?
Yes, they were
around
the same time, right.
Yes, I think he mentions Darwin in some
he
of
does.
His writings. Yeah.
Okay, but if you think about it, and Sean Carroll pointed this out recently, if you're a little tiny bird, like a 2-inch bird on the floor of the forest, and you're an insect eater, and you're foraging for insects, and you come across a pair of eyes, right? A lot of the mimicry involves eye spots, right? You see a pair of eyes, and it's dim. By the time you figure out whether it's a snake or some other predator, you're dead.
You're eaten. You're
right.
Gone.
So there has to be more to it than simply closely imitating a toxic species for mimicry to work. And what, there's an interesting study, a couple in Costa Rica, it is actually the kind of story that's fun to tell. The guy was a scientist doing some kind of research in Costa Rica on butterflies and moths, Lepidopterus, or an entomologist, and he had an accident and broke a couple of ribs. And they were in a very remote place, so that it was hard to get to the hospital. So he just bound up his ribs and stayed put until they healed. And being an entomologist, he couldn't go out in the field, but what he could do was collect moths. So he put up a black light and a sheet at night and made this enormous collection of all the moths in the area while he was convalescing. When he started to recover, he made a decision that he would collect the caterpillar and the chrysalis of each moth species that he had collected.
That's a hard job. He had to go out and find them.
Right, but that was his life's work. Okay. He did like 40 years of this. And what he discovered was in that area of Costa Rica, there were hundreds of species of moths and butterflies that have false eye patterns on the chrysalis and the caterpillar.
The chrysalis also.
Yeah. Now, I have photographs. Wow. That's a chrysalis. I have photographs that are on the website that you can see, which are just fantastic.
Yeah.
We know about eye spots on the butterflies, and some of the larvae are famous. They have the eye spots.
Caterpillars
have the eye spots on the back, usually, so that when they're threatened by a predator, they turn tail and run, and the predator is confused because they see these big eyes. Mm-hmm. But there are also eye spots on the chrysalids, which I didn't know.
Yeah, can you remind people what the chrysalid stage is, Carol?
Chrysalid stage is the last stage when the caterpillar has an exoskeleton, so its skeleton's the outer skin, and they outgrow it. As the inside of the caterpillar grows, it bursts the exoskeleton, and it's just like with a snake. Everyone knows a snake sheds the skin. It's basically the same thing. The exoskeleton splits, and underneath is a new exoskeleton that's loose around the body so that there's room for the body to grow. And this keeps happening. And in most butterflies, the fourth or fifth time this happens, they are ready to metamorphose into butterflies. And so what's underneath that last exoskeleton is the chrysalid, which is a stage where the animal is no longer a caterpillar. It's a fixed skin. They just hang somewhere. A moth makes a cocoon and does this, sheds the last skin inside the cocoon, and they metamorphose inside there and come out as a butterfly when they're ready.
Okay.
So the chrysalid has to defend itself. Chrysalid just hangs there or sits there. And we see them. A lot of them have little gold specks on them, which is confusing to a bird, and they have to hesitate and look for something else because it doesn't look like a seed.
Right.
And some of them have eyes.
Yeah, the light bounces off at the sun, I think, on those gold bands and gold specks.
Right. So this was just an interesting piece to think about, that natural selection favors this instant recognition, so that there's a hardwired response in a close encounter with a danger signal. And eyes are features that are instinctively to be avoided. I actually sent in three, but Jack will probably pick one, of owl butterflies, which we know they have big eye spots that even have a highlight. They're the most beautiful things. It looks like a painting of an eye. And those are also, again, instinctively trigger fear in a predator who will back off from a butterfly with an eye spot like that.
Okay, so the eyes are really an important thing in mimicry.
Very important.
Okay, so that's interesting. And the picture you have here today is really fascinating. Of eye spots on a chrysalid, right? And on the caterpillar. So that's good. I hope Jack gets to put the picture up because it's really fascinating.
Okay. Yeah. Now I don't know how much time we have.
We have 2 minutes in this first segment, so you can get into that.
So I have some little short ones that I'll talk about. This is about how insects' behavior and bodies are attuned to their social environment. This is about crickets, for a change.
Oh, crickets. Right. Oh, all right.
These are field crickets, and they attract females by rubbing their forewings together to make that chirping sound that we recognize. So male crickets that can't or don't sing for some reason lurk near crickets that sing, in order to take advantage of the females that are lured by the chirping males.
Is that right? So if you have a singing group, you'll have somebody just hang around who doesn't sing. But
there you go.
The benefit of this group, singers.
Right.
Terrific.
And some California biologists studied juvenile male crickets, and they found that juvenile males in this species who grow up around the chirping crickets tend to have bigger testes than those who aren't exposed to lots of chirping.
Is that right? So it takes chirping to get big testes?
Well,
in that species anyhow.
Well, it takes chirping, or it also takes a lot of sexual activity.
Yeah.
Because the chirping attracts the female,
right.
So they're around a lot more sexual activity, so they're more sexually stimulated, I would imagine. Right? I mean, mm-hmm. We can only hypothesize as to why the testes
That's
are bigger.
True. And we can't, take human values onto these crickets.
Well, we can think about
we can think
them,
about
but,
it,
we
yes.
can't be sure. Right?
Now, what kind, I don't know what kind of music would be best. I mean, I got an idea about that. I don't know. Maybe Beethoven, that would be good.
Right. All right. And then I'm following this with something in a similar, somewhat similar vein about guppies and about ladybird beetles. So after we take a little break, you will. I'll give those two little bits.
Sure. Well, this is Bernie Wides, and my favorite co-host today, Carol Butler, is with me. And as you know, we love to do programs on animal behavior and strategies for survival, like mimicry and sexual behavior. So we just learned about crickets. Very interesting that.
I think they're on break.
Immature crickets. Hanging around the musical singing crickets develop bigger testes, probably from more sexual activity. So with those words of wisdom, I think we're going to sign off for this segment, and we'll be back in a minute. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, a naturalist. We're back on the air with my co-host today, Carol Butler, and we're talking about insect strategies. And if you were listening before, you heard about this cliffhanger that we just did of immature male crickets, which they're probably too young to sing. Is that what it is, Carol, you think?
I don't know why they don't sing.
Why they don't sing. They're not very happy. I don't know what it is. So anyhow, they hang around males, crickets were singing, and either because of the song or because they are able to have more mates, I guess.
Well, or they experience
more sexual
activity. More sexual
activity.
Maybe of the older crickets.
Right.
They witness it.
They
so
witness it.
It's more of a turn-on.
I mean, it's like watching a porno movie.
Yeah, exactly.
That might be it. You never can tell. That would be good. Okay, so, Carol, you have some more topics for us now.
Well, we'll go from testes to sperm competition.
Oh, that's closely related.
Closely related, right. So this, the first little example is about guppies. Now, you know what polyandry is, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where females mate with multiple males. Right. So in that case, a male's reproductive success depends on both his ability to acquire mates and the ability of his sperm to compete effectively to accomplish fertilization.
Oh, so we have more sperm competition, which we've spoken about a lot before.
We've talked about that,
many critters do that.
Right, we know certainly with butterflies where they have multiple mates, there are all kinds of plugs that some of the males put in to prevent other butterflies from mating with her. She can expel the sperm, and there are also some fill the female's reproductive tract with non-fertile sperm to prevent her from mating again. So we've talked about that in butterflies. Now these are guppies. So female guppies are promiscuous, right? So they're polyandrous. And an Australian researcher found that males mate with females in this species using one of two strategies. Either courtship before mating, like we see in a lot of animals, swimming around, trying to look attractive, or sneak mating.
Sneak mating, oh. Mm-hmm.
So now males that sneakily mate are less ornamental than the ones that court the female, because naturally courting, they're competing externally, so they have to look attractive and attract the female's interest. The sneaky males had faster swimming sperm than those that use courtship.
Really?
Huh. So this was an interesting study to accomplish, and it shows the trade-off between sexual attractiveness versus an investment in the ejaculate. Right? Mm-hmm. So they don't have the attractiveness, but they have speedy sperm.
Speedy sperm. I'm trying to visualize that.
Which
okay.
Can hopefully outcompete the sperm right. of the they, some of the attractive.
They get there first.
Right. Exactly. Now switching to beetles. Another researcher in Canada studied the ejaculate of ladybird beetles. You have to think about the biologists too. These are years worth of study. To be studying the ejaculate of ladybird beetles. But entomologists are wonderful people. They're some of my favorite people.
They're very focused in on
they
this
certainly
stuff.
Are.
Right.
Okay, so males in this species, in good condition, transfer larger ejaculates or more sperm. But it really has not been clear until these researchers looked into this. It hasn't been clear whether the increased sperm content represents a shift in allocation of resources, which means more sperm, or just a larger ejaculate. Mm-hmm. So, the males of this species, and also of other insects, it's not just this species, they transfer, there are three components to the ejaculate that they transfer during mating. Sperm, which we know about. Non-sperm ejaculate, which is the material that carries the sperm, right? And a spermatophore, which the butterflies also introduce. And that is a nourishing...
It's like a packet of goodies.
A packet of goodies that is introduced into the... In butterflies, is introduced into the genital tract, and it serves to nourish the female while she's gestating the eggs. In the beetles, they get taken out to dinner. Because the spermatophore is ejected by the female and she eats it.
Uh-huh.
So
okay.
After mating. So that's her special treat.
Well, that's sort of traditional, you know. You have a date and you go out for dinner.
You have to read Donald Simons, The Evolution of Human Sexuality.
Right.
This is all,
that's where
all
it comes from.
Right in there. He describes it. It's the best book in the world. So what these researchers in Canada did was they manipulated the condition of the beetles. So some of them, and they found that the ones in good condition transferred larger ejaculates, larger quantity, but males that were deprived and kept in poor condition transferred ejaculates with a higher proportion of sperm. So that's really interesting. Yeah. That seems counterintuitive.
Yes, right.
But it's survival of the species. So even though they were not in good condition, they had more. They made more of an effort, putting more energy into sperm production, to reproduce their set of genes.
You think that's why they were in poor condition? They put a lot of energy into manufacturing sperm.
No, it's the other way around. They deprived them first, and then
they deliberately
deprived them to see what kind of condition they'd be in. Okay, then we now switching gears. This is a little segment about plants. We know that animal-pollinated plants have a complicated job. They have to attract a pollinator so that they can be fertilized and reproduce, but they need to try to remain relatively inconspicuous to herbivores, especially larvae, caterpillars that eat the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So there are different ways that plants affect the rate of pollination. They might alter the number of flowers. They might, the size and shape of the flowers varies, and that depends on which pollinator is invited based on the size and shape of the flowers. They have to have a good fit so they can get to the nectar. The rate and type of nectar production varies.
Mm-hmm.
And that also certain, we've talked about this on the show, certain nectars attract certain pollinators, and where the nectar is makes it possible to reach it, how quickly it's replenished, all of these things, as well as the seasonal timing of a flower.
Right, because that's what the insects are after, anyhow. They're after the nectar.
It's all about
that's
the nectar.
That's why they visit the flowers
right.
to get that sweet sugar water.
Right, and then incidentally, the reproductive cells brush off onto them, and then they transfer to another plant.
Yeah, so the actual pollination is secondary to what the bugs are looking for, because they're not really...
They're not looking to pollinate.
Right,
they just want to eat.
They just want to eat the nectar. Right.
Okay, so now there's a night flowering tobacco plant, and it germinates after fires that occur in the southwest of the United States. And this tobacco plant normally produces flowers that open at night and attract nocturnal hawk moths, which are big moths.
Big moths,
they're
right.
They're sometimes confused with birds, they're so big. Because it releases a benzyl acetone, which is what attracts the moths.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when there are moths, there are larvae. And sometimes the plants get attacked by the hawk moth larvae, which is destructive to the plant.
Because they're going to eat the plant.
Right, and then there will be no pollinating.
Yes.
So they need to defend themselves so they aren't destroyed and can survive to be pollinated. So, triggered by the oral secretions from the hawk moth larvae, right? The caterpillar is chewing up the leaves, the saliva is getting into the system of the plant, and that causes the plant to change, and the plant begins to produce flowers that open in the morning, that have less benzyl acetone and they begin to attract hummingbirds as pollinators.
Wow. So they switch their pollinator.
Right.
Wow, that's really fascinating.
That's really incredible,
yeah, that's
right?
Incredible.
I'm sure there probably are other plants that do this as well, but again, where the research is, and this research was done on this particular tobacco plant.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So that was another fascinating thing. I mean, we think of pollinators and doing all the action. But the plants are proactive, too.
Oh,
they don't just sit there and look pretty. They are proactive. They secrete this, what was it?
That's
an acetone of some kind?
Benzyl acetone, yeah.
Right, to attract the... Right.
And they secrete lots of different chemicals. It's a chemical, like a chemical soup that they give off that manipulates the pollination cycle.
So they could attract many different pollinators by changing the soup.
Right, the balance, depending on the environment and the habitat. Yeah.
And also, you said they switched to morning.
That's pretty incredible.
They bloom in the morning instead of at night.
Right, so that the day flying hummingbirds fly during the day.
Right, and the moths at night.
The moths at night don't find the nectar.
Right. Yeah. So, that's really fascinating. I think the more we look into the topics like this, the more we find fascinating stuff, that everything is really fascinating and all that.
It's certainly
And
true.
Life is fascinating if
it's
you're really interested in all this kind of stuff.
Certainly
like
true.
We are.
Right.
So, I think we're going to run out of time in the second segment. So, what are you going to talk about in the third one? Let's make this a cliffhanger.
Well, butterfly competition for mates.
Okay.
Motivational asymmetry, which means why do some males try harder?
Oh, well, that should be interesting. Okay, so this is The Naturalist, Bernie Wides, with my great co-host today, Carol Butler, who is our resident expert on sexual strategies and pollination and... mimicry and all those great strategies. And we're going to sign off. This is the second segment. The third segment, we'll be back in a minute, and we're going to talk about butterflies again, which is one of our favorite topics because we both work in the butterfly vivarium at the Museum of Natural History, which will reopen again in October. And it's one of our favorite exhibits, and we'll be back in a minute. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air for the third segment of this terrific show with my favorite host, Carol Butler. And before we get into this topic of about butterflies, I want to mention, remind everybody that Carol is an author. She has written many books. And Carol, tell us about your latest books and all that stuff that's coming out.
Well, the last book in this series that I did for Rutgers University Press is about birds of prey. And we just found out Friday that it should be shipped at the beginning of September. So that's very exciting. I wrote that book is called How Fast Can a Falcon Dive? I always get the title wrong. I wrote that with Peter Capignolo, who's an ornithologist at the Museum of Natural History.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a series that I've written about butterflies and bees and hummingbirds and bats. So I'm always keeping an eye out for new research on the animals of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have a book that is finished that's from a different publisher, from Story, about horses that will be coming out next year sometime.
So,
but right now,
stay tuned.
We're looking forward to Birds of Prey. That's going to be fun. And
yes,
we'll talk about that on the air when that comes out.
Okay, and I can personally talk about Carol's books because I've seen them all and read, I think, 3 or 4 of them.
Great,
and
thank you.
And they make great reading. Even if you're not out in the field somewhere, and it's a kind of book that you can pick up and read a chapter and put down.
It's all in questions, right?
It's all in question and answer format.
Right.
So it's great for families. They have kids, and you can, and they ask you questions. Daddy, what's the butterfly? Mommy, what is the moth? The difference and things like that. The answers are in Carol's books. So Carol, let's get back to you. You're going to talk about some kind of behavior of butterflies now.
Right? Okay. We know that in many species of butterflies, males compete for females in territories, right? We see that in the conservatory, that a male will claim a territory that has good nectar sources or that he feels is advantageous for attracting females, maybe because of the location, the sunshine. But what are the rules for this competition? And why does a particular butterfly try harder and outcompete the others? It's important to understand in evolutionary terms what goes into this competition. One of the elements we know about this competition for territory is body size, right? Body size can be a factor. Either way, it can be that a larger butterfly will prevail or maybe a smaller butterfly will prevail if agility access to nectar is easier for a smaller butterfly. Age is a factor. An older butterfly may be more persistent in the territory, or a younger butterfly may have the advantage because it's more active. Again, depending on the species.
It's not always the size that counts.
That's right.
It's strategy and brains and stuff. And being a small person, I know that.
Right. Okay. Usually, if you had to bet on who's going to win in a territorial contest, you should bet on the resident species, the resident animal, because the resident has a big investment in the territory.
You mean the animal that's there already?
The animal that's there
patrolling
first.
Patrolling his territory.
Right. And this is motivational asymmetry. That the resident has invested in this territory already. It stands to get a higher payoff because it's established and defended the territory against other invaders. So it's really got a reason to hold on to it. It also has asymmetry in information. The resident knows more about the value of the territory, knows that it's a good place to meet receptive females, has a history of successful mating there. So they know the value of hanging on to this, where the intruder sees it, oh, maybe this is a good spot, and pokes around and tries to take it over, but it doesn't have the same experience with it.
So through this experience, he's already been successful.
That's right. And knows that it's worth fighting for. Is more motivated. Right.
Uh-huh.
So this is easy to understand. So in some scientists from Stockholm University, staged contests between male speckled wood butterflies to manipulate their motivation. Now, what we know from other research is that body size and age don't have any effect on speckled wood butterflies in terms of territory.
Okay.
There's been other research that was not, those were not factors. These kind of butterflies, I like this part actually, it's very, very visual. They typically establish territories in large sunspots on the floor of the forest.
That
seems very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Because you think of a territory, I think of it as a bush or a plant or something, and here it's just a sunspot.
Well, like a baseball team in their home stadium.
Right, exactly.
Right. Yeah, well, sunspots move a little, though,
right?
Don't they?
In
the forest,
do.
They move.
They do.
Yeah.
So the researchers set up these outdoor cages in a forest about 100 kilometers south of Stockholm, and they covered the cages with green tarp, and they cut holes in them. They cut one large hole, which made a sunspot, and they cut smaller sections, which made sun flecks.
Mm-hmm.
So it imitated a natural grouping of sunlight on the floor. And the floor was covered with the same same material as the floor of the forest. So then they let a butterfly establish territory in that cage with a female. Then they removed the resident, and they introduced a non-resident butterfly into the cage. And each non-resident butterfly, of course one at a time, was allowed to either interact with a mated female for 30 minutes in the cage. So the female is in there, she's not available, she's already mated, so she's not open to mating with him, but nevertheless there's a female in the territory to interest him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other half of the butterflies that they studied, one at a time, were allowed to be in the cage alone for 30 minutes. And they wanted to see how that would affect their behavior when the resident butterfly was reintroduced to the cage.
Okay. A stranger in their territory.
And the males that had interacted with a female, no surprise, just like the crickets that chirped and had, the males that had interacted with a female, even though they didn't mate with her, were more likely to become dominant and take over the territory.
Okay, right.
So again, it's very interesting. So they learned
it's sort of learned behavior.
Right, this territory has females in it.
Right.
This is interesting. It gave them more motivation and more information about the value of the territory.
I assume there were pheromones in that territory from the female.
It could be.
You know, to attract the male, and he's sticking around and hoping that the female will show up again.
It could be. So what indicates dominance in butterflies, right?
Okay.
Well, I wrote about this because we know it from the conservatory, but we should spell it out. Many species have what they call non-contact aerial contests. We see that all the time with many different species.
Circling around each other.
Circling around,
right,
until one of them gives up. And that can go on for several minutes. They can really keep at it. And this is often followed by horizontal pursuit, in which the winner chases the loser from the contested area.
Right.
Right. And sometimes we just see horizontal pursuit as well, but this is what they counted as dominance in the experiment.
Okay. The dominant behavior where he's persistent.
Right.
Circle around. They do like a dance in the air. Like the male is circling around the female. The female maybe landed on a plant, and the male will hover around in a circle.
Well, we're talking about male competition here. So
and then another male will come. And he'll chase the other one away.
Right, right. And we see a lot of that. And there's, right, there's a lot about that in birds of prey, but let me not digress.
Okay. Right. Sink to the bugs.
Right. So then, now this is a good one. In the Lepidopterist Society Journal, there's an article by James Scott, who has developed a new terminology to describe mate locating behavior in butterflies and moths. They have different techniques that we describe as perching or patrolling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we also use terms from vertebrate behavior like leks and territoriality, which is really, for a lek is where a group of animals get together. Bats do that, some bats, where they get together, or birds do that, where they get together and they sing. And
as a group,
and they use the power of the group to attract the females.
Mm-hmm.
And just like with the crickets, others hang around the periphery and take advantage of the females that are attracted by the lek.
Sort of a chorus getting together.
Right. So we say zebra butterflies gather in legs, for example. Okay. But this fellow, he made up some terms, which are wonderful, that can be used as adjectives, nouns, or verbs.
Oh.
And these are to describe the mate-locating behavior of butterflies and moths. Okay, so the first one is rate, R-A-I-T.
Mm-hmm.
And that means when a male rests or lands, waits and watches for females at a mating site, and then flies out to investigate the passing individuals to determine if they're receptive females. So you might say this is a rating species, or these butterflies are raters. And the word comes from rest to await females.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, you could use that for other critters too.
Absolutely.
The word. Right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So then there are flating species.
What was it, flating?
Flating.
All right.
This is where males fly around a site to wait for females, and that is fly to await females, mm-hmm. right? And then there are fleeking butterflies and moths, mostly moths. Fleekers fly further away to search for a receptive female, right? And fleeking is
okay.
Right, fly to seek females.
Okay.
And of course, all of these, no matter what they do, they then investigate the females who are attracted to determine whether or not they're receptive.
Right. Okay.
And then there's flenting. Now this is also moths, generally moths, where they often fly far away to find a scent, a pheromone, that the female emits to lure the male for mating. We have Atlas moths in the conservatory, and the female emits a pheromone, and the male can scent it from miles away, right? And so he flents.
He flents.
He flents to locate the female.
In our conservatory, he can't fly too far
away. He can't flent too far, right? Don't really do
much. It's limited flenting.
Right. So,
but that out in the wild, I can see that.
Right.
There would be flenting maybe a half a mile in radius. So
that's right. And flenting is fly to locate the female by scent.
That's where
the terminology comes from.
Flenting.
Flenting. So one species may flent while the other flents. But you can see how useful this is, right?
That's a whole new lexicon we have. Is that the right word, lexicon?
Absolutely.
So I know the English language changes quickly. Every year, there's a new, they change the dictionaries, right?
Right.
So you think these terms will make it, Carol, into a general dictionary? Now, flenting and
flating and fleeking.
Flating and fleeking
and rating.
And rating.
Let me put it this way. So far, it was just in the journal.
Oh, okay.
He's been working on this terminology since 2006, because he wrote another article as preliminary terminology. So we'll see whether I was just at the Lepidopterist Society conference in Leavenworth, Washington, and nobody was talking about flating and fleeking and flenting.
It's too new.
But it's very new.
Well, folks, you heard it here.
You heard it first.
Right. What issue was that in of the Lepidopterist?
The most current one.
Is it a summer? A quarterly
probably,
magazine?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know now that in the latest issue of the Lepidopterist Journal, which Lepidopterist means butterflies,
And
moths.
Right.
So this guy developed these words.
Let me just. I just want to comment, because I mentioned going to the
Lepidopterist
Society meeting. That Bernie has been to that area as well. Okay. We just have a couple of minutes, but I want to tell your listeners about that area.
It's a beautiful area.
The most beautiful place I think I've ever been. If you ever are in the Seattle area, Route 2. Goes from Seattle, from the airport, you make a few turns and you're very easily on Route 2. And it's a couple of hours. It's not a bad drive. You drive through the Cascade Mountains to the Eastern Cascades, which is where the Lepidopterist Conference was. And it is the most beautiful drive ever. There is a rushing stream with white water adjacent to the road. It's a very good road. My son was driving. And I'm not used to driving with him because he's a recently learned to drive. He drives very fast, and usually my heart is in my mouth when I drive with him, but I don't want to criticize him. But it was actually, the road was so good.
Mm-hmm. Yes, especially, it's beautiful too when you're coming out of the mountains. and you see that stretch of territory to the east.
Absolutely.
And the whole terrain changes, because on the western side of the Cascades, it's wet and moist and right. beautiful forest. And you come out on the eastern side, which is in a rain shadow of the Cascades, it's dry desert, but it's also very beautiful.
Very, very beautiful.
Let me ask you one question. Yeah. We were there, and we drove up, and I remember there was a stand there, and they were selling blueberry ice cream.
Yes.
Did you stop at that stand?
We saw that. They grow blueberries
right.
and cherries all through that area.
Through the Cascades,
very,
right.
very lovely.
Yes, I remember that spot. We stopped off, and it was cool. It was like right. maybe 50 degrees or something up right. there.
And we were in Leavenworth. You're talking about a town for
right.
a convention. Leavenworth is a Bavarian-themed town.
Right.
But they actually do a good job of it.
Is that the place they have the murals on the walls in that town?
I don't know,
because we drove all through that area.
But they have the waitresses are all dressed in Bavarian costumes, and even the Starbucks has a Bavarian theme,
right.
and the McDonald's has a Bavarian decor. It's very amusing, but it's nicely done, and there are a lot of wonderful restaurants, and you're in the most beautiful area.
Yeah.
And we went in the field, and I saw butterflies puddling for the first time.
Tell people what puddling is.
Puddling is when butterflies come to a muddy water source to get minerals, and mostly males do this. They not only are drinking, but they're getting the minerals from the mud.
Right. They don't have enough minerals in their diet from just nectaring, so they look for mineral sources.
They need, sperm production.
Yeah. They'll even go to urine.
Yes, they like urine.
And feces on the ground because they need all the minerals.
One of the best photographs I got is of a butterfly, and I can't think of the name, on a big pile of feces, talking about feces. I got this beautiful photograph, and the people, the entomologists with me, everybody was more interested in what kind of feces it was rather than what kind of butterfly it was, because there are bears in those mountains.
Probably bears.
They decided it was coyote.
Oh, coyote, so it's small.
Right, but a big lump
deposit.
And this beautiful butterfly sitting on it, very happy.
Yeah, I saw that in Africa with the monarch butterfly on feces.
Right.
So, the reason they do it is because they need the minerals,
They need the minerals,
to manufacture sperm.
Right.
So, I'm glad you had a good trip out there.
Right, it was wonderful to see. I've seen photographs of puddling, but this was swallowtail butterflies of three different species, and swallowtails are big butterflies. Mm-hmm. They're 2-3 inches across. So it was very dramatic to see this big cluster of them in this muddy puddle in the mountains in Washington State. It was really wonderful.
Right. So I think we're running out of time.
Can I add one more thing, Carol?
One thing
that they never tell you about puddling when you read about it is that there are always a lot of bugs that also are there besides the butterflies. It was inundated with flies and mosquitoes and biting insects of every type. We all got bitten up while we were watching and photographing these beautiful butterflies.
Yeah, I guess they're all attracted there because the other bugs are there too.
And they
also get the minerals
right.
too. Okay, so I want to thank Carol Butler today for coming on the show, Carol.
My pleasure, as always.
Another fascinating show about all those strategies. And I could think of another word that you probably can't add to that one, but there's the word flagel.
Right.
You know the word flagel? It refers to a bagel, but it's a bagel that has been, the inside of the bagel has been removed, so it's more like a shell. And people buy it because they don't want to eat the inside of a bagel. They frequently take the inside out anyhow when they eat bagels.
Oh, right, scooped out bagels.
Yes, so they sell them out east in the Hamptons called flagels.
I never heard of that.
Yes, and they're toasted and they're almost like pretzels.
But we're going to Flitza in a little while, right?
We're going to have Flitza.
Going to fly out. We can't say Flitza. We're going to Ritza. We're going to reach out and have some pizza at this wonderful Roberta's restaurant where we do the recording.
Right. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back again with further fascinating broadcasts and with Carol and myself, and sometimes by solo. We never know what's going to happen. And I'll report some more from the conference in Tennessee. So this is Bernie Wides and
Carol Butler
signing off on the Heritage Radio Network. The program is The Naturalist.